three sentient beings within the Quran. You've got man, who is formed of sanding clay, angels, who are formed of light, and jinn, who are formed of fire. And so the angels obey the word of God, of Allah, but jinn and human beings both have free will.
This is your nautical lantern on the dangerous seas of darkness. Let's push off from the placid shore of the status quo and explore what's beyond the horizon. I am your host, BT, and this is Truth and Shadow, your podcast of the supernatural. In this episode, I will be speaking with Dara Mason, host of the Spirit Box podcast. And while he doesn't share the same spiritual and religious beliefs as I do, it has been important to me to reach out and contact people who have different views and experiences. This is to better understand the world and the forces, either good or sinister, that work in it. Especially as many of us are not globe-trotting explorers, we can get complacent in our own day-to-day lived experience. This brings up two specific ideas. One, the metaphysic, and where we see ourselves in the cosmic order. And two, the idea of our own ethnographic environment, which can lead to ethnocentric ideas and beliefs. To start with, metaphysics, as a philosophical inquiry into the fundamental nature of reality, has been a cornerstone of intellectual exploration across cultures worldwide. Its value lies in providing a framework to ponder questions, transcending empirical observations. Whether in the ancient metaphysical musings of Aristotle, to the intricate systems of Eastern philosophy, or even contemporary debates in Western philosophy, this discipline shapes how societies perceive existence. Exploring metaphysics globally allows us to uncover the unique perspectives that different cultures bring to fundamental questions. For instance, in Indian philosophy, metaphysical concepts like the Brahman or Atman and Maya offer a distinctive lens through which to view reality. Meanwhile, Western metaphysics, rooted in the works of philosophers like Plato and Descartes, tackles inquiries into substance, existence, and the nature of being. However, a caution against ethnocentrism is essential. Ethnocentrism involves evaluating other cultures based on the standards and values of one's own, often leading to a biased perspective. Applying this to metaphysics can hinder a genuine appreciation of the diversity of thought worldwide. So, recognizing that different cultures may conceptualize reality in ways that diverge from our own worldview is crucial to fostering a global understanding of metaphysical theories. By embracing a cross-cultural approach to metaphysics, we enrich our intellectual landscape and cultivate a broader appreciation for the multitude of ways humanity grapples with existential questions. In a world interconnected by ideas and information, rising above ethnocentrism and the study of metaphysics becomes not just an academic endeavor, but a means to cultivate empathy and a more comprehensive understanding of the human experience. Thank you, and enjoy the show. In the desolate shadows, where reality and the supernatural converge, a realm cloaked in mystery beckons. The domain of the djinn. As dusk descends, whispers of ancient enchantments linger in the air, weaving tales of shape-shifting entities that traverse unseen realms and secrets. Here are veiled, and the line between the living and the otherworldly blurs into an eerie dance of ethereal darkness. Here we call on one who has traveled to enigmatic lands, photographed the mysterious, and shares what he sees through the lens. He is an author, researcher, photographer, and host of Spirit Box Podcast. He is the traveler in the shadows, the photographer of mysteries, and fearless folklorist, Dara Mason. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. That's a lovely intro. You made me sound a lot cooler than I actually am, to be honest.
But, thank you. Yeah.
No worries. No
your, right. Your humility is world-renowned.
That's appreciated. Thank you very much. No, that's lovely to be here. Thank you for asking me.
For many of our listeners, they'll be unfamiliar with you because of where you go with your podcast on the Spirit Box. And one of those things that you do is you study and continue to study the esoteric.
Yes.
And from that, I wanted to bring you onto my show so we can talk about the reality of the otherworldly entities and how being ignorant of the unseen can lead to our own demise. Would you like to talk about your experience from the places you've been?
Yeah, sure.
People you've interviewed?
Yeah, absolutely. excuse me. So I suppose to kind of give some context with the djinn as kind of an area of conversation today, I spent kind of many years as a documentary and travel photographer, and I was always drawn to, say, some of transgressive areas to photograph, and a lot of kind of the subject matter that I would be photographing would be things like specific like religious cults or what I would personally find really interesting subject matter. So I spent time photographing Sufis in Kosovo, the Aghori, which are a Shivite Hindu sect in India, and then probably, which kind of kicked off the podcast, I spent some time in Delhi following a story on the djinn, which are the kind of the eponymous fire spirits that kind of you touched on in your intro. And basically from a lot of these different adventures, I kind of brushed up against the other and that kicked off. Well, I mean, I say kicked off research. It kind of just honed and focused lifelong interest and study in that area to making it kind of a real vocation. And I did a couple of videos on kind of some of the research that I'd done and talks that I'd done in various different areas there in London. I stuck them on YouTube and kind of people said to me, why don't you make this into a podcast? So that's what I did, you know. No, that was it, really.
It's a great podcast. You've labeled the new season two, which is like 30 episodes in, yeah. But you've done about 160.
Hey, something like that, yeah. There's been a fair bit, all right, yeah.
And one of the things that really drew me actually to listening to your podcast is because I, too, was interested in the djinn and what everybody had to say, because there's a lot of them out there. There's, you know, there's the one-legged kind, there's the ghoul kind. And
yeah, so many.
Isn't simply, you know, you rub a lamp and out comes Robin Williams and the Blue Genie. You know, there's a whole lot more to it.
There is. There's. It's vast, really. You know, and like while it's associated with Islam, it predates Islam significantly. You know, like,
yes.
A lot of the characters that come up within djinn folklore, they go way back. They're like Sumerian wind demons, that kind of thing, and you know, it captures a lot of the folklore, the history, the paranoia of the particular areas of the world that the djinn are associated with. But one of the things that I found kind of in my various kind of explorations and study in the area is that it's remarkably similar to, say, Irish and British fairy lore.
Indeed.
Like, really, like, granularly similar. And that's kind of, as you kind of explore these areas, you know, you kind of get, you start to realize how much you're being led by the nose, you know, when you think you're mm-hmm. kind of exploring these areas out of your own motivations. But when I look back over kind of the last 10, 15 years, of kind of research into this area and being drawn into this area, that, I kind of realized that actually, nah, I've been kind of pushed along gently, firmly, more firmly, and then gently again, to explore these areas to for whatever purpose that is, you know. It's very strange stuff, but you know, this is the way it goes sometimes, you know.
We all seem to be enamored with what we can't perceive. It seems to drive a lot of people to curious things.
I think so. Yeah, it does. It definitely does. Like, just to kind of, I guess, start some of the kind of the areas of interest. So what happened with the photographic story on the gin was, I went to Delhi to shoot a story on the gin. Now, the story was based on the travelogue of William Dalrymple, who's a Scottish author and historian. A fabulous author. He's very funny, very knowledgeable. But it was one of his first books, and it focuses on Delhi as being just like the kind of amazing city it is. And the book kind of it establishes itself in a couple of locations, which gives it the title, right, City of Gins. And I basically went to those locations to photograph them and kind of tie a story together following the book, but also kind of a documentary of exploring these areas where gin are said to be, you know.
And there's traditions and rituals that have grown out because of that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so kind of the first of those places was the ruins of Firoz Shah Kotla. And that that's one of the earlier settlements of modern-day Delhi. It used to be the 5th century city, Firozabad. And it's said to be home of 10,000 jinns. I'm sorry. Pardon me. Let me thought this was on... Do Not Disturb. Sorry about that. And that site is where... that site where we kind of first really met people who were petitioning the jinn to try and make things come true for them. It was extraordinary, really. Really, really extraordinary stuff. So that's where the first photographs came from. But what made me really kind of stand up and take more assessment of this really was what started happening about a month before I was going. Basically, my camera equipment started to break. Which is pretty key if you're a photographer. But I used to shoot a lot of like time-lapse night stuff. One morning I wake up, check the camera, play back the film of the evening, and I see the speck just move across the frames as I was whizzing through them, and I thought actually it was an insect who might have settled on the lens and was just slowly walking across, which wouldn't really work because it's like it takes 30 seconds to take a single frame. So for that to happen, it would have been like a fly would have to be sitting there for about 3 hours. So what happened was I took the camera into a repair shop in London, told them about it, they had a look at it, went back 2 days later, they're like, I don't know what this is. We tried to give it a clean. The dirt keeps coming back. I'm like, okay, really weird. He's like, but take it to these guys. And it's like this kind of back lane photography engineer shop, where it's like where the techies go to get their stuff fixed, right? So these guys are like amazing. They had a look at it, come back a week later. Now I'm like 2 weeks out from going to Delhi. And they're like, we can't clean this. We don't know what it's causing this dirt. We think you need to rip the kind of camera box out and replace it completely. And I'm like, this is a camera that's like under a year old. It's still in warranty. This is bonkers. Okay. Guess what I can't find? The warranty. And I can't find any evidence of purchase, right? So like, I can't find a receipt, right? So, I'm usually quite meticulous with that stuff. So I'm like, oh, okay, right. I'm now 2 weeks out. I got no camera or a camera that's just slightly messed up. What am I going to do? So I managed to get another camera body off a friend of mine who's an editor for a photographic mag. So that problem solved. Then I have this like really weird nightmare. Or like I'm sitting in what turns out to be one of the locations in Delhi, in Nizamuddin, and there's a man to my left who's got his head back to me. He's back of his head to me, and he's got like a white hat. And he turns and looks at me, and his face is decomposed. And it's very almost like cliche Temple of Doom stuff, where a snake comes out of one eye and goes in the other, and it says, "Don't come here, don't come here," right? And I'm. You know, if that happened to me now, I'd be like, yeah, fair enough. I've been told, you know, just take the warning. But kind of then I was like, well, was it a thing? Did it happen? Am I just having an anxiety dream? Am I putting too much importance in this? Anyway, I get to one of the locations, particularly the kind of the final location, which is a place called Nizamuddin, which is the tomb of the kind of foremost Sufi saint in the subcontinent of India.
Yeah.
And I'm taken to the area where the jinn, people with jinn problems are held. And there's a guy in a white hat and he's there eyeballing me and mouthing off. And it was like one of the first times that I've hesitated to take a photograph. Like I was genuinely perturbed because I didn't know what that photograph was going to cost me. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, this could cost me something that I don't even understand the value that I'm gambling here, you know, taking this image, you know. So it was a difficult one. I still took the photograph. It's a mixture of stupidity and bravery. So hard to say which. But it is, you know, I took the shots, came back, and I ended up kind of doing a lot of talks about the jinn, did an awful lot more research into it. I started to understand what was happening a lot more. But what I really found is that this was a very much a living part of the culture in that city, very much so. And it is a living belief in the city, you know, so... Like one of the differences, there's a separation between what are seen as kind of evil or unclean spirits and the jinn. Right? Mm-hmm. There's a separation. Now this stuff's all very ambiguous as well, right? So there's also overlap, right? You definitely get evil jinn, right? But if you can imagine the difference that you have, kind of like three sentient beings within the Quran. You've got man who is formed of sounding clay. Angels who are formed of light and jinn who are formed of fire. And so the angels obey the word of God, of Allah, but jinn and human beings both have free will. Now, if you look at some of the conventional origin myths of the good people in Ireland, the fairies, they are also said to be kind of originally angels who were cast out of heaven. So there's a difference. The difference between jinn and angels in Islamic lore or in Arabic lore, but in Ireland, in kind of like a Christian framework, the fairies are the angels that were cast out of heaven but didn't fall into hell, right? They weren't evil enough to fall into hell. They fell into the mound, right? They fell kind of...
They were just mischief enough to...
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
They were cast out, but not completely down.
Right. Okay.
If that makes sense.
Sure.
Right. And so you've got a very, very similar kind of origin myths in an Abrahamic framework, which is very interesting. And those things are thinking, well, that's very interesting. That's quite an interesting similarity. But then if you start to pull the thread a bit more about, okay, well, what are the other similarities? And let me just bring up my notes here. I've about four different windows open here, so my apologies. But... But basically, if you look at kind of the various different types of similarities between fairies and the djinn. You have an unbelievable amount of stuff. Like, it's just ridiculous. Like, you have abduction, you've got sexual attack, you've got a sexual relationship with humans, hybrid children, stealing, killing children, wind trapites, magic based invocation, right? You got inspiring of ideas and creativity, you've got lost time, you've got association with treasure. You know, if you think, you know, Aladdin and the lamp, what, you know, where is the lamp found? It's found in a location full of, you know, what do the leprechauns guard under their, you know, under the rainbow? I mean, these are really, you know, I'm trying to give the obvious analogies so they're familiar to people, but it's this association with, and that's just kind of the top level of stuff. That's just kind of the top line of stuff. I mean, it gets really granular in the sense of, like, you've got, like very, very kind of narrow, like very narrow and specific taboos, like for your dirty water from your home. Like, that's, you know, that's you wouldn't expect that to be kind of carried in an Abrahamic framework, right?
But anyways, we were talking about the similarities between the fae folk. You mentioned the similarity between the leprechaun and the gold under the rainbow and the lamp in the mound, basically, for the djinn.
Yeah, that's basically it's the where the what they're associated with, right? So it's that kind of thing of, like, they're associated with that treasure. But I'll give you an example, right? So there's no running water at a time in rural Ireland, and all the washing is done in a basin, and people throw the wash water out the door. This is the kind of very, very specific similarities. There's a superstition that if you threw the water out, you're in danger of hitting the fairy folk, right? And this would incur a very harsh revenge. So on any kind of household that threw water without warning. So people took great store by this. You know, they were very keen to comply with this. And they would have said something along the lines of, like dirty water is coming, so look out, you know? So it'd be like, Ishkasalika cocked mash led a hull, you know, so like dirty words coming, look out. And this would cover the person. So that was kind of like you're blessing yourself by saying something like that, right? And then that would mean you'd be okay, right? But various things would happen to people who threw the dirty water out. And like there was a story of a lady in a place called Milltown. In Ireland, and she threw the wastewater out one night without warning, and the fairies turned her face back to front overnight, and she had to get a prayer said over to get it back. Now, the interesting thing about this is that you have an almost kind of identical story in a work by an anthropologist called Dr. Barbara Dryskins. Now, her book is called Living with Djinns, and it's about her time. She's actually married to a gentleman from Cairo, and it's her time with the family and her study of their beliefs. And this is a piece from her book, and she's talking about, I think, her sister-in-law telling her about this story. So, Amira told me about a female relative of hers. This woman was cleaning the house before dawn while it was still dark because it was a feast day and she wanted the house to be ready for this occasion. So Egyptians say it's always dangerous to clean at night because the djinns wander around more then and there's greater risk of harming one. She carried a bucket full of dirty water outside, and in the street she noticed a dog passing. She tried to chase it away, throwing the water at it. The moment the water hit the dog, the woman went blind. She consulted many doctors and they found no physical cause for the blindness, and in the end she visited a sheikh and he treated her using the Quran, and several months later she regained her sight. And the first thing she could see was this dog, suggesting it was the djinn that possessed her. So here you have almost, you know, like very, very similar stories. And from like the other ends even beyond the Mediterranean, right? You know, so you've got a big, big, big chasm in difference. and yet you've got almost an identical taboo. Now, the difference for me here is that where you have taboos that are, say, in the context of Abrahamic faiths, so, you know, you've got a variation of the story you would find in Genesis, you would find very similar in the Quran, right? In terms of the origin of Adam. The big difference is you have the jinn there as predating human beings. Also kind of Adam and Eve are seen as equally responsible for taking the apple from the serpent. So you've got Abrahamic context. That makes sense. That makes sense how that could have been a carry-on from Christianity and from the kind of the religious beliefs of that area. But getting down to this kind of like, you know, specific things about throwing water out after mopping the floor, like that's, to me, is very strange that it would be like that level of kind of granular taboo would carry over or could be carried over by trade or the religion itself. It makes me think that there's something where I got to it is that it's two cultures describing the same thing. Two geographical areas, peoples of geographical areas describing the same thing through their own cultural lens. And this is kind of a symptom of that.
We can see the trade patterns of things happening within the Middle East specifically, you know, things being borrowed from Babylon and in the Babylonian exile of the Jews. That makes sense. That's fair. Anything happening into, you know, Eastern Turkey, et cetera. You know, you took pictures of, you know, Göbekli Tepe. I mean, it's sure, right, all of that could be traded all the way up through Rome. But it is kind of an interesting aspect to see that we have beliefs and practices that are all the way up into the British Isles and Ireland specifically. Yeah. And that draws, you know, one thing that I was looking at is the Tuatha De Danann and the similarities between them and the Anunnaki. Yeah. Not, you know, Zacharias Titchen's Anunnaki, but the view of them from the Sumerian Enuma Elish, for example.
That's really interesting. And it's a good thread to pull, you know, because you get similarities again with the Tuatha De Danann and some of the jinn lore and like to being kind of like specific, you know, what you have is like when you talk about the other world or the home of the jinn, right? You kind of have this idea of like Al-Ghayab, which is the kind of the unseen world, right? And it would be not identical, but similar to some of the ideas around of like fairyland or the other world, right? There's several different other worlds in kind of Irish lore. One of them is Tir na n Og, which is land of the young, and which is where the fairies are said to come from. But there's also the idea of location, as there is a geographical location where fairies are associated. Well, the Tuatha De Danann, are associated with, and that's they're said to come from the north, from four cities in the north. And in the north of the world. Now, what's interesting is you've got similar lore around the jinn where they're associated with Mount Quaff, right? Which is this mountain at the top of the earth. Now, in European maps up to like the 1700s, the Mercator map, which is one of the more famous ones, depicted the North Pole as being four islands surrounded by a whirlpool, surrounding a black lodestone mountain called Rupus Nigre, you know, the black magnetic mountain, which is why all magnets pointed north, right? Because it was a giant magnet mountain at the North Pole. But the jinn are said to have inhabited the slopes of Mount Quaff, and they're the light of their emerald cities. Was said to illuminate the sky. So you've got kind of, again, some crossover points there as well. And then the Tuatha De Danann are said to come from, have learned all the kind of the alchemy, the magic, all the great arts and sciences that they brought to the early Irish people. from four cities in the mm-hmm. north where they learned these things. And they've got these four islands. But equally, the jinn are said to have brought great inspiration. So it's, again, there's interesting crossovers there.
Absolutely.
And what did the Anunnaki bring? What science and...
They came from the north too.
Ah, there you go. That's interesting.
Yeah. There's all sorts of these little crossovers.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I mean, not only that, but you have Egypt, you have the god Set, who's said to have red hair and green eyes.
Wow.
And you didn't have any of that occurring naturally, except the people who painted their skin blue, according to the Greeks.
Oh, wow. Well, that's us lot.
Yeah.
And that, Scottish, to be fair.
I do believe that's the root of the word Celtic, because it's a Greek word that means those who paint their skin blue.
Ah, cool. That's really interesting.
Yeah, so you've interviewed several people, and I, you know, I spent some time scrolling back to your earlier episodes.
Yeah.
And I know you've talked to a lot of people, and I like to give you some time to just talk about some of those interviews that you've had, the ones that really struck with you, not merely just your experience in going and taking pictures of awesome places, but actually talking to people and seeing how the world is seen through the lens of other people.
Yeah. I mean, the whole point of Spirit Box, for me was, to try and get as many perspectives as possible on people's experiences, people's knowledge with the spirit world as a whole. You know, I was fairly agnostic in the approach, even though I was kind of, I've been practicing magic to some degree on and off for a long time, really since I was a teenager, but I was always kind of by myself. You know, I never would be kind of part of a group or indeed had kind of colleagues at all that I knew. The podcast, much like a camera, it's a great door opener. You know, it allows you to have kind of conversations with people that you just be genuinely interested to have conversations with, you know, and that's kind of where the impetus came from, was like Spirit Box being the name comes from those devices that people record, you know, electronic voice phenomenon and see if they can pick stuff up doing ghost hunting. So it's kind of a pun on that, like the idea being, you know, what can we learn from the spirit world through interviewing people who've got a lot of experience and different perspectives on it. I'd say kind of the most jaw-dropping ones for me were probably the witchcraft ones. When I started to hear about this figure again and again, the dark man or mm-hmm. the man in black, you know, which I've come very familiar with over the last couple of years now, and as this initiating spirit, and kind of learning about that was really, really interesting. And that's kind of dominated my life over the last couple of years, really. And has kind of really, I don't explore other areas now. I know exactly kind of where my own personal practice is, and it's very much in line with like a what you would probably broadly define as folkloric kind of craft, you know, folkloric witchcraft.
Sure.
That would be kind of where I would my practice would be, but you know, like most people, I'd have bits and bobs everywhere. It doesn't stop me praying to saints. It's I think the discovery of that and finding the patterns in reference to the same spirit in folklore that was thousands of years old, you know, like finding it again and again, and then kind of really brushing up against it in a very personal sense, you know, it's a life-changing experience. You know, I don't have any kind of hesitancy now in saying, well, spirits and magic are real. I know they are, you know, it's, you know, I have absolute confidence in that. And that's, that's kind of how it's fundamentally changed me. And there's been a number of interviews that have helped me get there. And I suppose kind of one of the interviews that kind of made my ears prick up was, you can see it come up in the kind of, I guess, in the earlier episodes, I'll talk about like the man in black in Irish folklore. And then kind of earlier episodes with the Blood and Ink Tarot with Elise Ursa. And she talks about being inspired to create this tarot by this dark figure who appeared in her dreams, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's so I started picking out this figure kept coming up again and again in my guests. And then it turned up in my life. And it's kind of one of those things that, like, even the actual picture that I chose for the podcast, which is like a figure standing up against a starry background with a kind of a red light in the where the head should be, right? That was me mucking about on a beach near where I live.
Okay,
right. That was actually a range finding photograph. So what that was designed to do was for me to allow my camera to focus on, take a test shot to get everything behind where this light is in focus, I know will be in focus, right? So I'm taking pictures of the stars, so I'm getting it tank sharp. That was the idea. So we give the camera something that it could hunt to focus on, and then lock it, and then take pictures of the stars, right? But I got this kind of cool picture, started playing around with it, and you know, that's me in the actual picture. But the interesting thing is this spirit, the Witch Father, you know, is said to have they bring the light of illumination.
Mm-hmm. Right?
It's also can be termed as the headless one who walks with eyes in his feet. So if you look at that image, and also it sometimes appears, you can see stars of the universe through his body. So it basically, from what I would say now, is symbolically, there's a lot of themes associated with the spirit in that photograph, and the photograph that I chose. That's kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, but like how many of my decisions were my own? Because you look back over, like, if you have a lot of spirit interaction that you're starting to understand and manage, that it's not kind of invasive stuff that's just like horrible and unpleasant and out of control, that I can look back and see, okay, these are the touch points and nudges that have been going on for many, many years, until kind of like there's the kind of the grand reveal. And that's where I think a lot of the interviews really helped me, because basically I've got 150 odd hours, maybe more, of kind of one-to-one conversations with people who have lots of experience or are experts in their field or have experienced similar things. One of my favorite shows is also with hereditary witch from the north of England called Shuley, and she talked about kind of how she'd been working with the dark man since she was a child. She had seen him since she was a very young girl, and how he'd been with her all throughout her life. That's an extraordinary show, really, really good one. Yeah, really, really good. Yeah, there's some tremendous ones. Yeah,
yeah. You talked about the dark.
It's hard to pick a few out.
It is. Yeah, you talked about the dark man, and see, I've done a little bit of research doing some fiction writing and stuff like that.
Oh, cool.
Trying to find, you know, you create a bad guy, you know, a cosmic horror bad guy, and you kind of have to figure out something that helps with the atmosphere of the story, right? And I found this guy. Yeah. His name, he's a blues player. His name's Robert Johnson. Have you heard about that guy?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like this guy can't play guitar, goes to the crossroads, classic story, right? Meets the dark man, and now he can play.
Yep. Yeah, he tunes his guitar, hands it back to him, and now you can play. Yeah, there's loads of stuff around that story.
Yeah.
And the funny thing about all this stuff, right? It's really great that you picked up on that, because I would say that the kind of the super intelligence that the dark man is an emanation of, right? Again, you've got the cultural specific versions of that. So the story about kind of Robert Johnson going to the crossroads is would be through kind of an African-American lens. So you could probably say it would be like more closer to like a voodoo spirit, like a Papa Legba or something like that. I'm not versed in that area.
Yeah.
But it's similar spirit with similar dominion, Lord of the Crossroads, you know, the Dark Father. And like an American hoodoo, you would have a very strong tradition of working with him, you know. But this story wonderfully, well, sorry, going back to my earlier point, it's not just witchcraft, it's also creativity.
Mm-hmm.
It's also stories, it's inspiration, you know, which again are associated with the fairies and the djinn, right? And it's also, you've got, there's a trickster element to this as well. And there's a mercurial part to it where it's never exactly what you think, or the minute you think you've got a bead on what this is, it will just twist out from under you and do the opposite. Right. And this is why you've got these witches called, you know, the English witches were called cunning men or cunning women, you know, because they had to be cunning to navigate the tricky ground of the trickster. But apparently this story, the one you're referring to, is absolutely the famous version of it. But it may have not been him. It might have been him that it's referring to a different chap. But your man, Robert Johnson, kind of like, it's been associated with him, but it's not quite him.
Right.
There's a lot of kind of like smoke and mirrors around it, which is absolutely what you'd expect with this spirit. You know, it's never straightforward. One interesting thing, though, is that you talk about music and Robert Johnson and the blues and that kind of stuff. And you look at the bands that have taken inspiration or credit that guitarists work. And you start to get into kind of Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones, kind of all the kind of obvious ones to that regard. But there's a really interesting interview with Bob Dylan. I think it's in the early 2000s. And he's asked, why is he still touring at his age? I don't know what age he is, but I mean, like, he's no spring chicken, you know. But he said he's just holding up his end of the bargain. And the interviewer obviously kind of eyebrows go up and kind of says, you know, with who? And he says, it's the bargain I made with the... I think he says something along the lines of the phrase "the king of the world" or the king from the world you can't see.
Yeah,
right. Which A could be, you know, him just kind of trying to create some mystique around himself, or B, perhaps he's telling the truth,
right?
You know, that he did do something like that. You know, he did go to the crossroads or an equivalent and work out what he wanted.
Bargained with whatever entity it may have been. Many would just say, oh, it's a contract with the devil. And it's like, I'm pretty sure the devil's not interested in one particular man. It could be any of a variety of trickster entities.
Absolutely. Or, you know, but I think the important thing is, like, all, you know, like, all tricksters are in the pay of the devil.
Oh, of course.
But it's also kind of understanding kind of what the devil is, you know, like, from my perspective, it certainly isn't, you know, they're kind of like fire and brimstone and drag you to hell version. But that doesn't mean you don't tread carefully. You absolutely do, you know. Like, it's one of those things of, like, being sure that you are aware or understand that something that isn't human doesn't share the motivations or understanding of what it is to be human. You know, you wouldn't talk to a lion like it's a human being. You know, it's probably not going to end well. And while that's a crude example, you kind of get what I'm saying.
Yeah, I draw the line, and I do talk about the fact that the spirits are intellect, pure intellect. Yeah. And because they're pure intellect, we can know them, obviously, like I can get to know you or vice versa, etc., because we have the capability of an intellect. And that means they do too. We can psychoanalyze them, therefore, also, and kind of get to know their means, modus operandi.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I talk about that they are, you know, they flow and they move like water and everything is different depending on where you are, because obviously entities in Islamic cultures are going to respond to the Quran. That's a fact. That's given. You know, we've seen that, you know, Jewish exorcism really only works with some of the stuff that the Jews are going to deal with. You know, the Dybbuk, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, entities like the Skinwalker in America is really only handled by the indigenous the indigenous shamans. And it's this realization that entities seem to be not really cultural specific, but work within a boundary, if you will, of cultural dynamic.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think, yeah, it does seem to be that way. Like there's massive commonalities on how these entities and intelligences engage, but the themes are universal. The manifestations certainly aren't, and the methods, as you say, of managing and dealing with them are culturally specific. I mean, it's you know, you get the idea of like little people all over the world.
Yeah,
you know, in countries that have never had any kind of like trade with, you know, what we would say kind of I guess any kind of like Abrahamic nations. Like they just didn't, like, you know, the original people of Australia, same thing, very very similar to fairy lore. Just it's already there, you know.
Yeah, there's an entire village in South America that was discovered a while back that all of the buildings are like 5 feet tall and the entrance ways into them is like a foot.
Wow.
And it's like, you look at these things and you go, are they meant for tiny people? You know, it reminds me of building, you know, little fairy homes and things like that out. And addressing the situations like, we got to give these guys their own place to be because they're bothering us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's the other thing that really was interesting is contract agreement. So the Fae seem to operate within this contractual view, but I haven't found that in the Djinn, for example, but I find it in demons in Christian lore.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they certainly can be like summoned and petitioned. Like when I was at that place I mentioned, for Furosh Shakolta, like there was a family there doing exactly that. They were going through, I mean, like it's kind of a pyramidal structure with a number of kind of different tiers, and it's just full of grottos. And it was almost like a Stations of the Cross type process. This family would go into each of the grottos, lighting little kind of devotional lanterns and leaving gifts and going to each one. And the family were doing this, I think they were doing this like for 12 days.
Yeah.
And when I asked them, he said, like, yeah, it's already working what we're looking for. So they were being petitioned. Equally, all over the place in that site were letters. And the letters were actually kind of, it's kind of a weird detail, but some of the mundane stuff that happened to this kind of makes me laugh. You know, it's like basically these letters were photocopied and they often had like a passport photograph stapled to it.
Interesting.
Right, so that the spirit could identify them, I guess.
Oh yeah.
But they would have and sometimes kind of like, you know, laminated or in like you know, the plastic sheets that you'd use in for your papers in university or something. And they were all over the place at different grottos. And they were specific requests. And they would range from anything from, I want to win the lottery, or I want to be famous in Hollywood, or, you know, help my family get over addiction problems, that kind of stuff. So there were letters to the jinn. These were petitions. And in exchange, there were offerings all over the place. And very similar to what you'd find in Irish folklore, there were offerings of bread and milk. You know, like famously, you'd get milk and butter offered to the good people in Ireland. There was also locks left, and little red string knots left all over the kind of the railings there. And what those symbolized is a bargain. So the lock, it literally is kind of like lock and key, you know. This is my agreement. If I get what I'm looking for, you'll get whatever it is that you've asked for. So, you know, it would not be what you would call like a very sophisticated contract, but it certainly was of that nature.
Yeah.
You know, that was certainly a thing. I mean, it's very similar to what you see with how people petition saints.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a similar locking tradition, but usually it's done on a bridge with people, isn't it?
It's a love spell, like essentially couples would lock their on a bridge together. Yeah, it got so bad in Dublin on the Halfpenny Bridge that they had to go and get an angle grinder and cut them all off, which I imagine is just lots of kind of like forlorn teenagers around Europe breaking up, you know.
sure right. Yeah, the idea is definitely there, and it is curious, you know, not tying as in promise making, and
yeah,
not tying or undoing knots to undo whatever might be bothering somebody.
Yeah, exactly. And then in terms of like the magical process of summoning the djinn, you know, it's similar to kind of what you would see as Western magic, right? But Western magic is a huge Arabic influence, like coming out of like cities like Harran in southeastern Turkey and what have you. So a lot of it will be based on kind of like magical squares, formula, and various different sigils, and then those used to some of the jinn. But I have it in good in good stead that the jinn feel different to demons. It's a magician friend of mine, and she works with both, and she said the jinn feel a lot more dangerous and unstable, and she says it's like electricity, where the demons feel slightly different. You know,
well, that is interesting.
But those summonings, I mean, particularly with the ritual magicians and demon magic, you know, or working with the Goetha, what have you, it's from what I've been told, like it's very direct. It's almost like you're challenging and bullying the spirit to appear inside a restrictive, you know,
place. Yeah,
like it's a magical prison, essentially.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
There was a time in my life where I had actually done quite a bit of ritual magic, and then I fell into a bit of, like, I tried ceremonial magic. It didn't work for me very well, and then I ended up something a little bit more natural. Yeah. The best thing that I found is called primal witchcraft in terminology, because it seemed to fit with finding a location of power. In this case, it was a graveyard. A farmer's graveyard, and I had simply was drawn to it for some weird reason. But anyways, I began doing things there with grave dust. I mean, it's almost like I stumbled into Appalachian magic without actually knowing what Appalachian magic was, because it was inspired. It wasn't like I didn't read about it. I read about ceremonial, you know, Crowley and Westcott and all the people, you know. And then I simply was like, look, I mean, this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to have answers into the world, and I'm not getting anywhere. And then it's like, something's like, hey, I can show you your answers. And it's like, okay. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of pursued this force, which was actually quite a negative and harmful entity towards me. It led to, like, you know, attempted suicide. I mean, it was not exactly a positive experience because it was definitely an entity of evil, not something that had anything good for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's dangerous stuff, you know, like the taboos are there for a reason, you know, like, and kind of when I talk about the dark man, you know, I talk about it in terms of, again, not just witchcraft, but also in terms of creativity. You know, if you've got a creative bend to you, you know, where whatever way that's expressed, you're probably going to have a hard life.
Yeah. I call it the shaman initiation process because it's what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you've got creative energy going through you, it can burn you up. You know, the world of art is littered with the corpses of people who've been burnt out or, you know, had to self-medicate with substances and that destroyed them. And like, you only have to look at, like, what do they call the 27 Club, where all those musical artists died at 27 or committed suicide and what have you.
Been talking about that quite a bit.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, that's a coincidence there.
You know, so it's, creativity is 100% a double-edged sword. And this is where, you know, when you're saying it's a shamanic initiation, I would agree with that in kind of the broadest sense. And I think our biggest challenge is that in the West, we don't have a language for that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that means we have people going off the deep end and getting medicated and getting, you know, more and more vulnerable when, you know, I'm absolutely not saying that some people are better off on medication. That's not remotely what I'm saying.
It leads to sociopaths and psychopaths sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's a spiritual issue and not a biochemical one or a psychological one.
Right.
Which is where I would say that the, you know, some of the sheikhs that I met in Delhi are very aware of, and they would describe people being brought to them. They would do their piece of kind of going into kind of inner vision and working with the saints at the shrines that they were at. I'll have a process of determining, is this a evil spirit? Is this a jinn? Or is this a mental health issue?
Mm-hmm.
In which case, if it's a mental health issue, you know, you need to go over to get treatment from somebody else. If it's jinn, then we start a different process. So, you know, when this is something that it's in the West that we don't really get, you know, like we've got plenty of, like, you know, horror films and TV shows to it, but it's all very, you know, it's all kind of big demonic possession stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's like 0.001% of what happens. Spirit interaction happens all the time to most people, and they're just not aware of what's happening. And I think in Islamic culture, they're a lot more aware of jinn interaction. Now, equally, it's seen in the same light. It's not like you're like, yay, you know, jinn are in my dreams, brilliant, you know.
Right.
But this has got to do with, again, like a monotheistic view of these things. This means, you know, I would often term working with spirits, or some spirits, working with little gods, you know. I think it's understandable that the kind of an Abrahamic framework is not going to want you to work to little gods, you know, unless they become saints, and then you can kind of, there's like a side lane where that's acceptable, you know.
Yeah, culture does definitely take a hold of the things it likes and keeps them whatever is in control at the time.
Yeah.
Cool. Let's go ahead and shift, and we'll talk about some of the things that you're working on, et cetera. If you've got another book in the works. I mean, if you're doing another conference like Gin and Tonic, killer name, by the way, and any kind of else. let's just talk about stuff that you're working on, and we'll use that as a wrap up.
Sure. Yeah, cool. Well, my book, Song of the Dark Man, Father of Witches, is out in August. It's available for pre-sale now. That's kind of a book in two parts. So the first part is me kind of really describing, focusing in on Irish folklore, but talking about the kind of the folklore and the kind of the paranormal fingerprints of the dark man in kind of cultural folklore of Britain and Ireland, and then a lot of Irish mythology, and tying it into kind of some of the kind of fundamental witch lore, and then tying it into kind of some of the accounts of the Scottish witch trials. And then the second half is it's interviews with those who have direct experience of the dark man in his various different forms. And that ranges from people who have just walked up onto Glastonbury Tor and, you know, to see the full moon, and next thing they know, there's a 7-foot, like, dark 2D man leaning up against the wall, starts talking to them, you know. And of course, Glastonbury Tor is associated with the Welsh Gwyn Ap Nudd, who is an analogous figure to the dark man. Right down to kind of like ceremonial magicians or you know, very much adepts talking about the equivalent in their own traditions. It's really interesting stuff. And then it kind of culminates with myself and two witches essentially going out to the middle of nowhere to call him. And what happened with that?
And would pre-order be through your website, or would it be through Amazon?
Yeah, it's through Amazon, and the links are on my website for the various, because there's Barnes and Noble and a couple of other bookshops where you can get that kind of stuff from. And then what else have I gotten there? I'm going to have a think about maybe going back to my photographic roots and maybe making a little documentary film to accompany the book. And I've got I think I've got the next idea for my book, you know. And equally, like, so much of the book was spirit led, you know what I mean? Like, we talk about inspiration.
Yeah.
I would have sat down, and some chapters that were all me were the hardest ones to write. Then the other ones where I wasn't necessarily in the driving seat. And I know that sounds bonkers to most people, but other writers and people who are creative will kind of know what I'm talking about, where it just would come through me. Now, equally, I'd be absolutely shattered afterwards. But I start, you know, writing poetry and all this kind of stuff. And you know, like, I'm not a poetry writing guy, you know, like,
right.
I'm not that kind of dude. You know, but you know, it was coming through me. It was just the experience opened up all this art and creative flow that had come out. So yeah, maybe an accompanying film, that might be something. And then I've got my kind of next idea for the next book, which will be in similar territory, but really zoning in on kind of some of the more mercurial trickster elements to this. To this energy. The first book is more around the Saturnian bit. It touches on the Mercurial, but more Saturnian.
Fantastic. Awesome. Well, thank you for coming and talking. Appreciate you on my show, Dara. It was really nice.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. This is a free podcast based upon the value for value model. If you find value in this or any episode, you can return that value by liking the show, subscribing to this channel, leaving a review, or sharing with a friend on your social media accounts. You can also donate on my website. Thank you again. This is BT for Truth and Shadow Podcast. You are the light in the darkness.